You're listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadlow, Episode 21, Destruction. In his book, Holy Terrors, Thinking About Religion After September 11th, the historian of religion Bruce Lincoln proposes a typology of religions according to their stance toward politics. Most religions would best be termed religions of the status quo, in which religion reinforces the political and social institutions. Sometimes, though, a religion will become what Lincoln calls a religion of resistance, opposing, usually through passive means, the power of the state. Every once in a while, one of these religions of resistance will take one more step, transforming into a religion of revolution. Religions of revolution not only actively and often violently oppose the power of the state, but do so on ideological grounds. That is, they articulate an ideology or a set of reasons that stand opposed to the status quo and its power relationships. This typology is a useful place to begin our discussion of the last few years of the Second Temple. As we have now repeatedly seen, throughout the first century CE, Jews passively resisted Roman actions when those actions threatened Jewish religious sensitivities. When in 40 CE Caligula sought to erect his statue in the temple courtyard, remember that the Jews were said to have met the imperial troops under Petronius, presenting themselves and their families for slaughter, rather than allowing him to execute the emperor's orders. Yet in 66 CE, the Jews in Jerusalem ceased to favor passive resistance. Instead, they openly revolted. They went from a religion of resistance to a religion of revolution. Why? The story of the Jewish revolt, often called in Jewish historiography the Great Revolt, is relayed to us primarily by our friend Josephus. Even in his first book, The Jewish War, written shortly after the revolt, Josephus's account is hardly disinterested. His account veers toward two complementary explanations for the revolt. In the first place, awful Roman administration made revolt inevitable. We left off our last episode with the miserable and kleptocratic administration of the Roman procurator Florus in Judea. He, not the Romans generally, or even those in the administration above him, was truly responsible. At the same time, most of the Jews wished to keep the peace with Rome. On the Jewish side, it was the work of a few hotheads, extremists, who drove the Jews from resistance to revolution. If not for these two extremes, one on the Roman side and the other on the Jewish side, the revolt never would have happened. And now, in the aftermath of the destruction of the temple, Josephus implicitly claims things might return to normal between the Jewish residents of Judea and their Roman overlords. Fortunately for us, Josephus is a rather sloppy writer. He prosecutes his case vigorously, but not consistently. The result is that Josephus gives us an explanation that is considerably more complex and less clear. The facts that he gives us don't always support his explanation, but their own more complex explanation remains open to debate. In this episode, I want to trace the outbreak of the revolt to the destruction of the temple in 70 CE, along with the mop-up operations at Masada a couple of years later. I have two main questions, though. First, why did the revolt occur at all? Second, why was the temple destroyed? Rome, after all, conquered many peoples, but one of the ways that they maintained their ability to rule those peoples was by respecting their religious sensibilities. Why would the Romans destroy the Jewish temple? Let's return to Bruce Lincoln's typology. According to Lincoln, three factors generally account for the transformation of a religion of resistance into a religion of revolution. First, the material conditions must substantially weaken. Things have to get bad. Second, the religion must articulate an ideology that opposes and replaces the status quo. Finally, the religion must attract new adherents emerging from its insularity. These three factors are interesting starting points for us, if only because the Jewish revolt doesn't seem to fully conform to any of them. The first century is often seen, following Josephus, as a time of unremitted decline. Things grew from bad to worse. And yet, as we saw in the last episode, there was no inevitability in the course of events, and the tenor of Roman-Jewish relations varied greatly by time and place. Sure, there were crises, but these crises were resolved and relations improved until the next crisis would come along. Was the revolt a result of steadily increasing tensions, exploding 60 years after Archelaus's death? As tempting as this thesis is, the facts don't fully conform to this explanation. In fact, when we look clearly at the events leading up to the revolt, they conform much more to yet another manageable crisis than they do to an explosion of tensions. As described by Josephus, the direct events leading to the revolt, its proximate cause, if you will, began in Caesarea. The problem was not one of lessening material conditions and Florus's rapaciousness, but rather a very specific and local set of civic disputes. For a long period, Caesarea, the seat of the Roman administration of Judea, was predominantly Gentile. The local population, including the Jews, largely spoke Greek rather than the Aramaic that was spoken inland around Jerusalem and in the Galilee. Being a Roman administrative center, it is little surprise that Caesarea also contains the largest concentration of inscriptions in Latin found in Palestine. Relations between the local Jews and Gentiles, the Greek citizens of the city, had before on occasion erupted into violence, all played out against the background of Roman administration. So too this time. Around 60 CE, the Jews of Caesarea claimed that they were entitled to govern the city. The Greeks naturally resisted, and the Roman procurator of the time, Felix, sent the whole matter to Rome for judgment. Nero took his time making his decision, but in May 66 CE, he awarded control of the municipal government to the Greeks. The decision undoubtedly emboldened the Greek residents, some of whom responded by taunting the Jews, by sacrificing birds on the Jewish Sabbath next to the synagogue. As intended, the Jews were outraged, and, perhaps also as intended, a riot ensued. The Roman procurator Florus responded by punishing the Jews. News of the riot spread to Jerusalem just as Florus, in an apparently unrelated action, decided to extract a relatively modest amount of money from the Jerusalem temple. Some riots ensued in Jerusalem, which included public mockery of Florus. Florus sent troops in, but even now the Jews met these troops with passive resistance rather than revolt. The chief priests, Jewish nobles, and most eminent citizens all vainly pleaded with Florus to keep the peace. Angered by the mockery, Florus sent troops rampaging through Jerusalem. According to Josephus, 3,600 people were killed that day, and Florus crucified even Jews who had obtained Roman equestrian rank. Despite the step of violence, the Jews of Jerusalem withdrew rather than confront Florus's troops. Florus brought in reinforcements, and now the Jews began to fracture. The chief priests and nobility urged the people toward peace as a more fractious party, invoking the fresh memory of the Roman slaughter gained ground. As the new Roman cohorts marched toward a crowd of defenseless and most suppliant Jews, a few of the Jews jeered. That was all it took. The cohorts charged, the people rioted. They were at a stalemate. At this point, as the dispute became known to Florus's superior in Syria, Cestius Gallus, Agrippa returned from a trip to Alexandria. According to Josephus, Agrippa gave a rousing speech to the Jews, urging them not to revolt. He primarily pressed two arguments. First, that justified grievances against individual Roman procurators do not justify revolt against Rome. Second, the claim for liberty is far too late, and that given the number of superior powers already conquered by Rome, there would be no hope for success. It is worth dwelling for a minute on the second argument. Josephus has not to this point mentioned in his account of these events an ideological commitment to liberty as a proximate cause of the revolt. That is, we already saw the rise of the so-called fourth philosophy, proclaiming that God is the sole ruler and sovereign, but this was many years earlier. It, or something like it, apparently survived or was resurrected. Here is the ideological position that Bruce Lincoln suggests that we look for. But how popular was it, and why did Jews, however many, come to embrace it? This is a complicated question. As we will see in a minute, once initiated, the revolt spread quickly among Jews in the Galilee. Moreover, one or two of the factions that supported the revolt did seem to have some developed ideology supporting Jewish liberty. An idea, by the way, that we see explicitly in the coins of another Jewish revolt some 60 years later, that known as the Bar Kokhba revolt. Did the Jews rise up against Rome in order to achieve liberty? While this is one possible interpretation, it is hard for me to believe that this somewhat abstract notion motivated most of these Jews. But if it didn't, then what did? Economics, for one. The continuation of Josephus's account is telling. Agrippa's speech was not received well, although he was supported by the principal citizens, chief priests, and most notable Pharisees, the upper classes, in other words. As things got increasingly worse, these upper classes occupied the upper city of Jerusalem, the neighborhood of the rich, as can be seen today in some of the opulent archaeological excavations in what is now the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. The revolutionaries appear to have been drawn from the class just under them. It was the son of the high priest, Eleazar, son of Ananias, who convinced the other priests to discontinue the sacrifices offered on behalf of Rome. This might be a sign that the sub-elites led the revolt. They made a bid for power. Be careful of what you wish for, though. If they began it, they certainly did not have control of it. As the revolutionaries battled the upper classes, who were reinforced with Agrippa's troops, for control of Jerusalem and the temple, the Sicarii joined in with the revolutionaries. The Sicarii, you might remember, appeared earlier in the century as Jewish political assassins. Now, though, they helped to storm the upper city, and after destroying the palaces of the Jewish elite, went straight to burn the public archives containing the records of debts. In order, Josephus tells us, to win over a host of grateful debtors and to cause a rising of the poor against the rich, sure of impunity. The situation in Jerusalem became increasingly messy. In addition to the Sicarii, a man named Menachem, who was an ideological leader of the fourth philosophy, stormed Masada, took arms, and returned to Jerusalem with troops aspiring to take lead of the rebellion. He was somewhat successful at holding up the remaining upper classes along with the Roman garrison in a Jerusalem stronghold, while managing in the process to kill the high priest, Ananias. Eleazar saw his control of the revolt slipping away and assassinated Menachem. There were now, in effect, three wars going on, the most minor of which was that of the Jews against Rome. Another was Eleazar's party against the upper crust of Jews, and the third was within the revolutionary camp itself. As Eleazar consolidated his control, though, the revolt against Rome picked up steam. Eleazar's troops, according to Josephus, treacherously massacred the small Roman garrison that had surrendered, sparing only their leader, who promised to turn Jew and even be circumcised, in Josephus's words. At the same time, the Jews of Caesarea were massacred, although it is unclear to what extent this was a popular uprising against them or a Roman military act. This was the spark that set the Jews of Judea into a full-fledged revolt, rising up against non-Jews across Judea and Galilee. The animosity was mutual, as other cities in the area rose against their Jewish inhabitants. It is here, I think, that we find the primary cause of the wider revolt. The ideological commitment to liberty might have driven some of the leaders in Jerusalem, and economic factors certainly played a role. But it was a combination of fear and rage, not against Rome per se, but between Jews and Gentiles in the Greek cities. Once the tensions erupted into violence, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, as they say. To Rome, this looked like revolt and was to be dealt with accordingly. Support for this interpretation can be found in the events that immediately followed. Rome sent in a legion from Syria through the Galilee, where in fact the Jews by and large quickly surrendered. Their beef was not with Rome. The legion marched quickly on to Jerusalem. In retrospect, the best thing that could have happened to the Jews at this point was a quick Roman victory in Jerusalem, then in November of 66. Jews were still in open conflict with each other within the city as Rome began its siege. Due to a combination of the strong defenses of Jerusalem and a bumbling Roman military command, however, the Roman forces retreated with significant losses. This loss precipitated the full-out rebellion. There was no turning back. Only now did the Revolutionary Party in Jerusalem begin to expand the scope of its activities, appointing military leaders for other districts. As I mentioned in the episode on Josephus, Josephus himself was assigned to the Galilee. It was not as if there was no Jewish intrigue in the Galilee, though. Even as Josephus sought to prepare the Galilee for the oncoming onslaught from Rome, a Jew named John of Giscala schemed against him. John, Josephus tells us, was a no-gooder, a brigand from a poor family. Perhaps more relevantly, by this time John was also rich. According to Josephus, John opposed him simply to gain power and enrich himself. In any case, Nero appointed Vespasian to lead the Roman army against the Jews, and once again Galilee was quickly subdued. Despite exaggerating his own successes, Josephus himself appears to have been easily captured in 67. John of Giscala took refuge in Jerusalem, where he quickly gained command of a faction of rebels. By the time the Roman army made it to Jerusalem, the Jews were again at each other's throats. The Zealots, the war party under Ananos, and the faction under John were all fighting for control of the city. Ananos fell to the Zealots and their allies, the Idumeans, whom they summoned for help. With the Jews in disarray, Vespasian marched south in 68, subduing Judea as he went. Vespasian, though, seemed unsure about how to proceed. The problem was not in Judea, but in Rome. There had been an uprising in Gaul, and in its aftermath, and after Nero's death, Rome quickly went through a succession of emperors. Galba, Otho, and Vitellius all served as emperor in the year 69. It was only with the ascension of Vitellius, according to Josephus, that Vespasian's troops could no longer take it and proclaim their own general as emperor. Vespasian took his troops south to secure Egypt on his way to Rome, where his forces had already disposed of Vitellius, and, according to the later Flavian propaganda, the people of Rome had acclaimed him emperor. Meanwhile, of course, there was still an active rebellion in Judea, now mainly confined to Jerusalem. Vespasian entrusted the Roman prosecution of the war to his son Titus, who had accompanied Vespasian to Egypt, but had then stayed behind when he, Vespasian, embarked for Rome. Titus marched his army back to Caesarea to prepare for the final assault on Jerusalem. In the year or so that the Romans were largely occupied with their own affairs back home, the Jewish rebels in Jerusalem struggled against each other for the upper hand. The Zealots had now split into three groups. One group was led by Eleazar the son of Simon, a second by John of Giscala, and a third by Simon son of Gioras. They each controlled part of the city and periodically attacked the others. This infighting led to famine. It would seem to have been a perfect opportunity for the Romans to crush the rebellion. Titus marched on Jerusalem with four legions, an impressive force. With him was both Josephus, who had earned enough trust to have been released from his bonds, and Tiberius Alexander, Philo's nephew, who was now a trusted commander of the Roman armies. The arrival of the legions was ironically the best thing that could have happened to the Jewish factions. Facing a common threat, they coordinated their military action. And remarkably, as the Romans began their work building fortifications for storming Jerusalem, the rebels conducted a successful raid, routing the 10th Legion. Other successful raids on the Roman forces followed. Despite Josephus's predictable attempt to portray Titus as a wise and brave leader, it is hard to avoid the impression that Titus actually was outwitted. Titus was only 30 or 31 at the time and had never seen exhaustive military action. Just the few years he spent with his father easily subduing the Galilee and Judea and limited engagement in Egypt. Behind the impressive walls of Jerusalem, the rebels appear to have devised tactics that relied on stealth and surprise against the far superior Roman forces. That they were relatively successful points both to their own cunning, but more importantly, to Titus's inexperience. Inexperience in this case, though, could only delay the inevitable. In May in the year 70, the Romans breached the first wall of Jerusalem. 5 days later, after close and bloody fighting, they captured the second wall. Only the upper city, including the temple and surrounded by a third wall, remained intact. Titus sent Josephus at this point to exhort the remaining rebels to surrender. Josephus claims that his long speech caused a significant number of Jerusalem's residents to desert the city, and that Titus allowed them to go free. Whether or not this is true, Josephus himself admits that his exhortation had no effect on the rebels or the outcome of the final assault. In this speech, Josephus, like Agrippa 4 years earlier, acknowledged that an important platform of the rebellion was that of liberty, but also, like Agrippa, said that this desire was late and misplaced. "How much more impious are you than those who have been defeated in the past," Josephus claims, asserting that God has deserted them due to their impiety. "My belief, therefore," Josephus continues, "is that the deity has fled from the holy places and taken his stand on the side of those with whom you are now at war." This is an important claim theologically, as it disarms the potential argument that God was himself defeated by Rome and its own gods. God, rather, was using the Romans to punish his people for their sins. Interestingly, Josephus lets it slip that his family, including his parents and wife, is among the rebels. His father would be imprisoned after the fall of Jerusalem, and one wonders if they actively sided with the rebels. 2 weeks after the fall of the second wall, the Roman earthworks were nearly completed around the third. Here again, Titus was outwitted, and the Jewish rebels succeeded in destroying them. Titus, though, had more on his mind than simple military success. As he contemplated how to proceed, Josephus tells us, he feared, moreover, that the glory of success would be diminished by the delay, for though time could accomplish everything, yet rapidity was essential to renown. Titus was looking for personal glory. The final assault commenced on July 20th. The third wall soon fell, and the remaining rebels, under the command of John, holed up in the temple. By the end of August, the Romans were prepared for the final assault on the temple. But what was to be done with the temple itself? Josephus reports the Roman deliberations concerning the fate of the temple. The problem was that the Romans did not routinely destroy temples. They knew that it could be taken as an act of impiety. Temples, though, were also not routinely used as fortresses by Rome's enemies. In Josephus's account, Titus decided to save the temple. However, in a parallel account by a later Christian writer, Sulpicius Severus, who might be dependent on the lost work of the Roman historian Tacitus, it is Titus who, opposing the advice of his counselors, decided to destroy the temple. For my money, I would take Sulpicius Severus in this case over Josephus. It is not as if Sulpicius Severus is in general to be trusted more than Josephus. He too has an agenda, in this case showing that the Romans were hostile to the Jews. Considering the circumstances and later events, though, it is more plausible that Titus went for the big victory. Remember that he was young. He did not have serious military experience, and certainly no significant military victories to boast of. And his father was just made emperor. Titus needed to prove himself. And indeed, when a few years later Titus himself would succeed his father, the victory in Judea would become critically important for Flavian propaganda. Titus's arch famously depicts the sack of Jerusalem, and the Roman imperial coinage depicting the victory was widespread throughout the empire for years. These coins, minted in gold, silver, and bronze, tended to personify Judea as a bound woman sitting under a palm tree over whom loomed a Roman soldier. The so-called Jewish tax imposed on Jews and Judeans, there's some uncertainty about its scope, became important for the Flavians as well. Titus's brother, the Emperor Domitian, who succeeded Titus in 81, expanded the scope of the tax, probably in an attempt not only to fill the coffers, but at least as importantly, to remind the Romans that his family had gained this victory a decade earlier. Titus did not just need any victory in Jerusalem. He needed a decisive one. Given the difficulty that the Romans had suppressing this revolt, the rebels' military use of the temple, and the widespread knowledge of the Herodian temple as a majestic symbol of the Jews, it is not hard to imagine that Titus at least leaned toward its destruction. When Josephus reports that Titus tried in vain to restrain the impetuosity of his frenzied soldiers, as the temple began to burn, we must conclude either that Titus was a weak commander or that he did not try very hard to restrain them. Again, the latter seems more likely to me. 639 years and 45 days after Haggai built the second temple, according to Josephus's reckoning, the temple burned. God, though, had left years earlier. In one of Josephus's accounts, the priests actually heard the divine host departing. By the time it burned, it was no longer God's house. It was just another monumental building, stone and mortar. It took another month for the Romans to finish the operation in Jerusalem. Some of the rebels fled back to the upper city, but they did not last long. Large portions of Jerusalem were burned. All of it was plundered. Josephus says that 97,000 prisoners were taken, some of whom were brought back to Rome for the triumph, while others were used as slaves in Egypt or sent to perform in the gladiatorial games throughout the empire. Simon and John, the two remaining leaders of the revolt, were captured and brought back to Rome, where Simon was executed during Titus's triumph, and John would rot in prison. Mop-up operations continued another 3 years, concentrating primarily on the last stronghold of the rebels at Masada, near the shores of the Dead Sea. Josephus gives an extended description of the siege and the decision of these Sicarii to commit suicide rather than surrender to the Romans. The story, which is not entirely plausible and which is contradicted by some of the archaeological finds, was widely popularized by the Israeli archaeologist Yigal Yadin. In any event, from a military perspective, this operation was largely inconsequential. Rome had already achieved a decisive victory, and the Jews had lost their temple. And thus, in Jewish historiography, the Second Temple period ended. Imagine, though, if you were a Jew living in 71, 72, or 73, whether you somehow survived the destruction in Judea, or set out the war in the Galilee, or Egypt, or Babylonia, wherever. Would you think that history had changed? How would you now worship the God of Israel? Would you assume that the temple would soon be rebuilt? In the next and final episode, I will take up these questions and reflect more widely on the history of the Second Temple period and the transition from Israelite to Jew. You have been listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadlow. The original score is by Neil Ginsberg, with vocals by Michelle Tattenbaum. Technical assistance was provided by the Language Resource Center and the Instructional Technology Group, both at Brown University. More information can be found at msatlow.blogspot.com or at mlsatlow.com on the public education page. I welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.